You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Today, we'll hear from Republican U.S. Senator Joni Ernst and her opponent in November's general election, Teresa Greenfield. Also today, why one advocate for more humane treatment of those convicted of crimes says community policing and defunding the police may not be enough to make real change. But first, after years of proposals to supply body cameras to the Sioux City Police Force, this Monday, the City Council voted to make that happen. At its weekly meeting, the Council unanimously approved a resolution to buy body cameras for the police department. The city is paying more than $260,000 for 120 camera units, the operating system, and the equipment. Sioux City Police Chief Rex Mueller said the body cameras will be used for most interactions, with a few exceptions.
We also have some things written into policy that would allow them to be turned off during especially sensitive incidents, such as interviewing a victim.
After the vote, several citizens voiced their support for body cameras. Ike Rayford, president of the Sioux City chapter of the NAACP, called into the meeting.
We obviously know that this is something that the citizens as well as the NAACP would like to see happen and move forward with.
Support for adopting body cameras in Sioux City gained support after African-American George Floyd was killed by Minneapolis police officers in May. Since the death of George Floyd, there have been protests and public calls for changes in policing and prisons. Some advocates say it's time to defund police and move money into community and social services. Others say remote monitoring with an ankle monitor helps keep people out of prisons and with their families. However, researchers and authors Victoria Law and Maya Shenwar say these measures could backfire and cause yet more problems for prisoners and the community. Their new book, Prison by Any Other Name, takes on the challenge of looking at many innovative law and order practices that are supposed to help people in the community. Co-author Victoria Law says the timing of the release of the book is particularly poignant in the aftermath of the death of George Floyd.
Well, it's tragic that it takes more deaths and more tragedy to inspire these conversations across the nation, but it's also hopeful that people are having conversations about police accountability, what to do to create safety and promote safety. And of course, there are a variety of conversations about how best to do that with people. Some people saying that we need to reform the police by giving them body cameras or sensitivity training or de-escalation training, and other people saying, well, if we look at the fact that policing grows out of a system of colonialism and racism and white supremacy, the modern day police force comes out of the slave catchers from the antebellum days, and looking at the ways in which this kind of history and this kind of force cannot actually be reformed to create and promote safety. So it is a heady and inspiring and momentous time to be in to see these different conversations where people are actually acknowledging, yes, something needs to be done on a wider scale. It's not just one or two or five or a dozen bad apples, but it is the entire system that needs to be overhauled.
I was reading in the book how you discuss, for instance, electronic monitoring, having the ankle bracelet on, and so people can't really go very far from their home. If they do, they're in a lot of trouble. They can't necessarily even take their kids to school. They can't go to meetings if they have addiction issues. You point out that it might actually be making it harder for them to sort of really get back in society.
Yes. There are approximately 200,000 people on electronic monitoring right now. There are two ways that people can be placed on electronic monitoring. One is as an alternative to incarceration. So if you are in jail or prison, you could be released. Or if you are in jail, you could be released. Instead of paying bail, you could be released on electronic monitoring rather than staying in a jail that may be overcrowded and may be a vector for coronavirus. Or if you are sentenced, you would ordinarily be sentenced to probation, you would be sentenced to electronic monitoring. So it would be your alternative sanction. And I want to note for listeners who are unfamiliar with this that with a few exceptions, such as Harvey Weinstein or Jeffrey Epstein, who can buy their way out of many things. Electronic monitoring is usually used for people convicted or facing charges that are low-level, usually nonviolent offenses. So it is not necessarily people who would be serving long prison sentences otherwise. These are people who are doing or who are either facing charges of or convicted of nonviolent crimes that do not necessarily pose a threat to public safety and to the community. So it's a way in which you can keep people who are who would perhaps not be under any sort of confinement or a very low level of confinement under a greater set of surveillance and control than ordinarily. And as you pointed out, it's a way in which it impedes them from being able to reintegrate themselves as a family member or community member. Like, you can't take your children to the store. You can't go to your grandmother's birthday party. During a pandemic, it is especially alarming because you cannot necessarily go seek emergency medical care for yourself or your family members if you don't have prior permission. So many of your listeners have probably been sheltering at home or are emerging from sheltering at home or want to emerge from shelter at home. And I want to stress that electronic monitoring is a form of sheltering at home in which you every movement outside of your door needs to be pre-approved. So there is no running out of toilet paper and going to the store, realizing that everybody has bought all the toilet paper and going to the next store. It is asking your electronic monitoring officer or probation officer for permission, usually 1 week prior to the date that you want to go to the store, saying what store you are going to go to and what time you are going to the store and what time you expect to be back. And if store number one doesn't have toilet paper, bread, and milk, you are not allowed to go to store number two, even if it's just a 10-minute drive away, because that is not on your pre-approval list. And to go there might mean that you are sent to jail or to prison. And during a pandemic, that could be deadly.
We have drug courts here, and they have them a lot of places, and treatment, methadone. You talk about the limitations of those things as well. I think, you know, people, especially in this part of the country, see that as a great innovation that we even have that, but those things are not without their issues too.
There are more than 3,100 drug courts across the United States. And again, I want to emphasize that drug courts usually deal with people who are convicted of nonviolent, low-level offenses. These are not people who, again, are seen to pose a great threat to public safety. And in theory, it seems that it would be better to go to drug court where you would be able to still stay at home with your family, in your community, and you would have to abstain from using drugs. But it also comes with a lengthy list of restrictions, such as having to attend support groups or drug rehab groups, having to check in with the drug court every month. There are no supports given for if you have to go to drug court and you also have to pick up your children from school or from daycare, or you don't have childcare. This means that you might possibly lose days at work and possibly lose your job if you constantly have to skip out of work to go and fulfill these requirements. And sometimes this has become a pathway back to prison, sometimes for longer periods of time than if somebody had initially pleaded guilty to a low-level drug offense and just served their jail or prison time. In Oklahoma, 40-something percent of people in drug court end up back in prison, often for longer sentences than if they had pled guilty to their original charge.
Your co-author, Maya Shenwar, has a sister that has been incarcerated, and that seemed to influence her activism in the area of American law and order and the way you looked at things when you two wrote this book.
From having known Maya and from having spoken with her at length and having worked on this book with her and having helped her with her previous book, which is that centers her sister's experiences more, is that, you know, this did influence a lot of how she was able to see things. She saw her sister go through drug court, you know, go through drug rehab, go through all of these programs, and none of them helped address the underlying issues of why her sister was addicted to drugs and was using drugs at a rate that it interfered with her ability to be present as a family member and a community member, to be present as a parent. So she saw her sister go to juvenile detention. She saw her sister go to drug rehab. She saw her sister come out of drug rehab and then get arrested, use drugs again, go to jail, go to prison, get out, and start the cycle again. Her sister was her sister passed away a few months ago after we had submitted our final manuscript, and her sister was in drug court at the time in which she overdosed and died. And being in drug court did not give her the tools to address why she was using substances, and instead just was another set of rules and regulations for her without actually saying, like, wait, what is happening with you, where you have a loving family, you have all of these things, what is happening in your life that you keep falling into this pattern of using drugs, getting arrested, going to various forms of confinement, whether it is locked in drug rehab or a jail or a prison.
In the book, you mentioned some alternatives that are seeming to be helping with the situation to some extent. One of them in the Bay Area, another one in Minneapolis. What do these different projects do differently that you think works or will work or will help?
Well, for one, so some of the initiatives and projects that we talk about are projects that focus on people's needs and underlying causes. So in the Bay Area, there is an initiative called Build the Block, in which people in a specific Oakland neighborhood got together and they talked about creating a neighborhood directory so that that way they did not have to rely on calling 911 all the time. So it's getting to know your neighbors, getting to know what your neighbors' needs are and what their strengths are. So people got together and they created a neighborhood directory in which people could say, I have two children under the age of 10. Somebody else might say, I have asthma, or I have diabetes, or I'm at high risk for COVID. But somebody else might say, hi, I'm an EMT, you know, and knowing that you have an EMT right down the hallway might mean that when somebody is having a medical issue, you don't necessarily have to call 911 knowing that the police are going to come with the ambulance and the EMT people and often show up beforehand. And for a low-income community of color, this could mean more violence rather than support and help. Somebody else might say, I'm retired and I can look after, you know, your children under the age of 10 when they come home from school so that they're not sitting at home by themselves because you can't afford childcare or daycare or an after-school program. So it's not necessarily let's try to solve the most egregious threats of harm first. It's how do we lessen that reliance and how do we get to know each other so that when there is more of an emergency, we are together and we actually know each other and can respond as a community rather than as individual people in their individual houses or apartment buildings saying, hey, I think something is happening there, but I don't know what to do other than to pick up the phone and call 911. There are other groups such as in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, a group called the Crisis Nursery Program, which is basically what it says, an emergency crisis daycare program and night care program because it's 24 hours for parents who need emergency childcare because maybe they are having a medical emergency, maybe somebody is getting arrested, maybe somebody just needs a break from their children. And especially in the COVID era in which everybody is cooped up at home with their children day and night, I'm sure many parents know the importance of just getting a break so that that way there aren't issues of somebody losing their temper and perhaps, threatening or harming their child or them being, them having child welfare called on them because they left their children at home while they went to a job interview or while they went to try to go apply for unemployment benefits or any of the myriad things that people have to do in order to survive in society. And this is a way in which the community is providing a resource. And instead of penalizing people for not having resources, saying, we understand there is a need for childcare. And sometimes that childcare might need to happen at strange hours. It might have to happen at 8 o'clock at night or at 6 in the morning. And we are here so that that way you don't end up falling lower and lower into the system.
Sense of all the sort of a perfect storm of health problems and all the issues that have gone on with the unfortunate and tragic death of George Floyd. And have you had people notice the book more and ask you more? Has it become something that people, obviously, people are much more interested in issues of community policing and things like that?
I think so. I think that our book came out at a time in which people are looking at these issues much more critically, with a much more open mind around what can we do if we don't rely on policing. People are more open to this idea because, again, if we think about what happened with George Floyd, he was not killed because he was considered a threat to public safety. Somebody in a store thought that he had a fake $20 bill and called the police and called 911. And that resulted in his tragic death at the hands of the police. So people are saying, what can we do instead? What can we do to lessen our reliance on the police? And again, as your first question brought up, some people are saying we need to reform the police and we can do these measures: body cameras, diversity hiring, sensitivity trainings, de-escalation trainings. And other people are saying we don't need the police to address every single issue that is happening, that police are currently called upon to address. People don't need to call the police if somebody is having a mental health issue and refuses to take their medications, or the tragic case in Atlanta where a man was asleep in the drive-in in a Wendy's and was fatally shot by police. Police didn't need to be called in that instance. Somebody else could have been called. Atlanta actually has a diversion program that could have been called instead, but instead people called 911 and the result was that the police shot and killed this man who was simply sleeping in a drive-in. So I think that people are seeing we don't need to call police for every instance in which we don't know how to deal with this. And we can also start developing our own tools and resources for dealing with instances that are not instances of immediate danger and harm. So what could be done instead of calling the police? And this has meant that people are open to these ideas that we have in the book about looking at true alternatives that meet people's basic needs so that they not only survive but thrive in society.
That was Victoria Law. She's a co-author along with Maya Shenwar of the book Prison by Any Other Name. And the authors look at different ways to help keep people out of prison without causing extra problems for them as they go forward with their lives. Support for The Exchange comes from Gregory Giles, investment advisor representative with Legacy Financial LLC in Sioux City, serving the financial planning and investment needs of clients since 2004. Information about Legacy Financial and Greg Giles is available at legacyfinancialllc.com. Financial planning and advisory services offered through RDA Financial Network. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Iowa's Republican U.S. Senator Joni Ernst and her Democratic opponent Teresa Greenfield are vying for a Senate seat this November. Greenfield has had great success raising campaign funds from Democratic donors and organizations, and she and Joni Ernst have been running constant ads on Iowa radio and television stations. Greenfield reported $6 million in campaign funds at the end of June, and that was the highest ever amount by an Iowa Democrat, according to her campaign. Senator Ernst reported around $9 million, which her campaign said is a record in its own right. I talk with both candidates on today's program. First, I speak with Greenfield about her priorities if she is elected senator. We also talked about the very tight race between her and Senator Ernst and her priorities when it comes to who she will take money from.
When I got in this race last June, Mary, I made a decision not to accept one dime of corporate PAC money. A very sharp contrast with Senator Ernst, who has taken more than $2 million in corporate PAC money. And I'll tell you what, when it comes to putting Iowans first on just about every issue we care about, We're not going to get results until we end that kind of political corruption, ban corporate PACs, ban dark money, overturn Citizens United, those kinds of things. I grew up on the farm, and my dad always said, there's no boy jobs and there's no girl jobs. There's just jobs that need to get done. And every farm family out there knows that's the way it is on the farm. And so the very first job that I published that needs to get done is to do just that and that kind of political corruption. And it doesn't just stop there, though, Mary. You know, Senator Ernst still hasn't given Iowans answers. She got caught illegally coordinating with the dark money group set up by her top political aides, and she hasn't given Iowans answers as to why. Now, here's the problem. When you take that kind of corporate PAC money, it's clear that Senator Ernst puts those corporate donors' interests ahead of the interests of Iowans. And a real good example of that is the big oil corporations and their PACs. She's taken money from Exxon, Chevron, Marathon, and she voted for a fossil fuel lobbyist to head the EPA. The EPA has issued 85 ethanol waivers against Iowa's corn producers and our ethanol and biofuel industries. Jobs have been lost. Plants have been idled. The price of corn just keeps going down, I swear. And she can't come back here to Iowa and explain to farmers why she voted like that. And so she attacks me instead. But we're going to continue to let Iowans know that we're going to put them first. And one of the ways you do that is you just don't take corporate PAC money.
You talked about ethanol and ethanol waivers and what has been going on and what Joni Ernst has done in relation to that and the EPA. What would you do if you became a senator?
I'll tell you. I grew up on the farm, and I'm a product of the farm crisis. I watched families lose it all, and my parents just about lost it all. They had to sell their crop dusting business. They had to sell their hogs. They never farmed again. Us five kids had to leave the rural area. There wasn't any work. We couldn't farm. You know, farm families are struggling again. Today, you know, net farm income is down 75% since 2013, and bankruptcy rates are an eight-year high. We have to end haphazard trade policies. We have to end reckless tariffs, and we have to work hard to restore the RFS, to get back on even footing, to make sure that our farmers and small communities can compete in the marketplace. And as I've traveled this state and talked to farmers in Floyd County and O'Brien County and Warren County, and oh gosh, all over the state, they want their markets back. They want to compete. They want a level playing field. And that's something that I would be working hard to do as the next senator from Iowa.
I know you're also interested in helping out small towns, targeting investment for small business and more investment in minority-owned businesses as well. And part of this, also, you would like to have an expansion of the Affordable Care Act.
You, Mary, I just published another one of my jobs to get done. I call it Small Towns, Bigger Paychecks, because everybody, you know, wants to make more money. And our plan really focuses on a few key things. And if you get a chance to visit with small businesses, you'll hear what their needs are about. And as someone who has been a businesswoman, worked in small businesses from running bean walking crews back on the farm to working my way all the way up to sitting at the boardroom table of a small business, we had about 8 employees. One, small businesses need expanded access to credit, and they need us to cut the red tape. Too many of our small businesses don't have enough resources on hand to cover 1 month of typical expenses like rent and utilities and their payroll. And that's really unsustainable in terms of their cash flow. So we need to make sure that they have access to that kind of credit. And remember, Iowa's a state of small towns and small businesses. Half of our workers in the state work in small businesses. And so it's just really key to our economy. They're going to need more PPP loans. We had the opportunity to tour the Adel Fund Center out in Dallas County earlier this week. And while they're open again, you know, their cash flow is down significantly. And they have relied on both unemployment benefits, PPP loans, and other tools to keep their lights on and stay in business. Second, paired with that need for capital and credit, we have a workforce shortage. We just need a stronger workforce, a higher skilled workforce. And I went to Iowa Lakes Community College. I worked at a Pizza Hut. I made enough money to pay my rent and buy my books, pay my tuition, you know, and get a beer on Friday night. And students can't do that today. And I want to make sure that we're working and making some changes to make sure that community college is debt-free, skill training programs are debt-free. I talk an awful lot about promoting apprenticeships where you can earn while you learn, just like my first husband did. He was a lineman for the power company and IBEW member. So mirroring the opportunity for credit so people can start small businesses, but also investing in that skills building so folks can get a living wage job or start their own small businesses. My plan includes a couple of things, though. Also, infrastructure. And this is one of the things I've been disappointed in both parties. We haven't passed a robust infrastructure plan that can create good jobs, but also really improve our communities. You may know, but Iowa is 50th in the nation in bridge suitability. Now, those bridges aren't Democratic bridges. They're not Democratic bridges, and they're not Republican bridges. They're broken bridges. And we need leaders that want to roll up their sleeves and invest in that kind of infrastructure, along with everything up through broadband, internet. And, of course, COVID has disrupted so much. And education is part of it. And if you're a family that doesn't have high-speed internet, or you're a graphic designer who's working from home and you don't have high-speed internet, you know, you're unable to work or unable to get the education you need. So we have to have an infrastructure package. And then we got to get back to buying more American and bringing home some of those jobs. We just have had years of this haphazard trade policies and big corporate tax loopholes that have made it easier to ship jobs overseas. And Iowa small manufacturers have suffered. And we've got to close those loopholes and make sure that our projects are buying American and have those kind of requirements to rebuild right here at home. And then finally, as you mentioned, my plan does include an element that talks about inclusive and equitable growth. And we need to make sure that every Iowan can pursue their dream and dreams of starting businesses. We only have about 15,000 minority-owned businesses in Iowa. And so right here in Polk County where I live, you know, Black Iowans are denied loans at a rate more than twice the county average. And so we've got to make sure that we are putting in place policies to ensure that everyone that wants to open a business can get the capital they need.
Funding a lot of these initiatives, I think a lot of people say, well, that would be great, but how are we going to pay for that?
Sure. Yeah, you know what? I think that investments in infrastructure are just that, an investment. And those dollars go to improve our communities, create good paying jobs. These are investments for the future. You know, Senator Ernst, her priorities, she voted for a tax bill that has raised the debt by $2 trillion, gave breaks to the largest corporations, the richest in this country, and she didn't seem too worried about how we're going to pay for that. And I'll tell you, those benefits, the majority of them did not come to the small businesses or the small manufacturers or the hardworking folks here in Iowa. Me, I believe these are investments. They're investments that make our community stronger and make our businesses stronger and gives everyone just a fair shake at their American dream.
That was Iowa U.S. Senate candidate Teresa Greenfield. The Democrat is running against incumbent Republican Senator Joni Ernst in the November general election. I talked with Joni Ernst about how she has worked to help Iowa farmers deal with the changing economy and the coronavirus. I also talked with her about the current CARES bill, which she believes will provide more paycheck protection for businesses who are trying to survive the pandemic. Here she is.
So we've got a phase four package that is currently in the works, and our Iowa families will likely see it'll be another round of direct relief, and I'm hopeful that that will include not only that direct payment to those parents, but then also include $500 for each dependent, regardless of age. And that's something that I've heard about from Iowans, and that's what I have been pushing for. So with our families, we really want to see expanded child care opportunities. I'm really pushing for that, as well as support for diapers for those families that really need access to that, and also for domestic abuse survivors, because we have seen an increase in domestic abuse during the quarantines and the isolations. I'm also fighting for our rural hospitals and making sure that our health care systems have the supports they need. And for jobs and workers, I'm making sure that we have a second round of support for our small businesses, so they would be able to draw down on those dollars, yet once again, forgivable loans, and you can use that to purchase PPE. And then as well, I do have a bill that would support our essential workers and offer them a suspension of their payroll and their income tax, and just reward them for being out there, you know, fighting through COVID-19 and keeping our economy up and running as much as we could. And then always for our farmers and our biofuel producers, really pushing to make sure that we have those supports for agriculture in this package as well. So we still have a bit of work to do on it yet. The negotiations are underway, but, you know, every day we continue to make progress on it.
Ethanol and the ethanol industry has certainly had a few rough years, and here in Iowa, it's really shown with one of our ethanol plants just northwest of Sioux City here going down for a while. Do you think that more needs to be done trying to keep, I guess, both the president and also the oil industry to make sure that they're abiding by the rules set up in the RFS?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's always more that we can do. There's always more. One, making sure that we're investing in infrastructure so that we can deliver E15 year-round to consumers, making sure that they have choice at the pump. Very important. I do know that we still do have a number of those warning labels that are out there on our pumps, which does tend to scare people away from E15 unnecessarily. And so making sure that we are seeing the removal of those labels as we have E15 year round. And that's something that I fought very hard for, pushed the president on. He did follow through with that, but we still have to make sure that our consumers have access to it. So, you know, there's always more that we can do, and certainly we should be trying to deliver as much on ethanol and other biofuels as we can. So during the Biden-Obama administration, really, there was no effort to move forward with E15 or any other types of products. So we do see at least an administration that has made advances. So we can't forget that. 8 years of Obama-Biden, they didn't do anything. But we have brought a focus to our biofuels industry through this administration and through the work that I've been able to do with those colleagues from the Midwest and a president that does believe in biofuels.
Your opponent, Teresa Greenfield, has been very critical of your work trying to promote ethanol, saying not enough has been done, too much has been given away to the oil industry. She's also criticized a lot about your use of corporate PAC money. What are your responses to some of these criticisms?
Well, I have a record of service and standing up for Iowans, getting things done and leading even when it's not the popular thing to do in Washington. I mean, if you look at our differences, I have been a leader for Iowa, born and raised in the county that I still live in, still fighting for rural America. I've served at all different levels of leadership, both at the local level as our county auditor in a rural county, moving on up into the state legislature, and now to the United States Senate, where I've cut perks for Washington insiders. I'm a tireless advocate for women and abuse survivors. I'm a champion for farmers, veterans, and our working families. I have all of that under my belt, even before I came into office, you know, serving in many different volunteer roles throughout the community, serving my community, and providing leadership. And meanwhile, Teresa Greenfield has a history of failed real estate, not even leadership, who has prioritized her own personal gain over Iowans and our communities. So again, let's take a hard look at who's shown leadership for the great state of Iowa, our rural communities, and hands down, I've been out there swinging and fighting for Iowa every step of the way.
I wanted to ask you before we end here about a couple of your initiatives that you're involved with. One of them, another effort to help veterans, and then this bill that would take on anarchy and violence in the streets.
It really is as simple as this, Mary. If lawless protest zones like, you know, Seattle's CHOP or CHAZ or whatever they're calling it now, if they want to exist autonomously, they can do so without our federal taxpayer dollars. And that's what my bill would do. It would prevent federal taxpayer dollars from going to those autonomous zones and to the mayors and governors that are enabling the lawlessness to continue, or those mayors that prevent law enforcement from actually going into those areas and policing as they should be doing. We have seen many instances where there have been shootings, there have been rapes, and yet the mayors are saying, no, you can't go in. You can't go in to their law enforcement officials. We don't want to exist in a place that allows that. The poor folks that are living and working in these areas, they feel helpless. So this is our bill, our solution to cutting back. If they do want to be autonomous, no federal taxpayer dollars. And I've talked to groups in Iowa about this as well. And our moms and dads, they are concerned about what they see going on in other communities. They do not want to see that in Iowa. They want to see it peaceful protests, absolutely. But certainly when things get violent and we have mayors that are abdicating their authority to protect their citizens, we just certainly can't allow it.
I know you're also working on another bill that would help veterans.
Well, certainly as a veteran, I am always working on the veterans front, not only protecting those men and women that are currently serving in uniform, but also those that have served and are out there in our communities across Iowa. And we have made promises to those veterans, and we certainly need to live up to those. I'm a combat veteran myself, and I know from my experience that, of course, one of the areas that I've focused on, that not all wounds are physical, visible wounds. And so I have focused very much on veterans' mental health and making sure that we are providing treatment, expanded access to mental health care for our veterans, and many, many other issues that I've worked on for our veterans. And I'm just thankful to have the opportunity to represent folks that have served our country, served us well, and now we need to serve them well.
That was incumbent Republican Senator Joni Ernst of Iowa. She's running against Democratic Senate candidate Teresa Greenfield in November's general election. Listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. A recent investigation by NPR found doctors and other healthcare providers still prescribe highly addictive pain medication at rates widely considered unsafe. Government studies and medical research shows even though the U.S. makes up 5% of the world's population, Americans consume 80% of the world's prescription opioids. The CDC says in 2018, more than one in five in the U.S. had an opioid prescription filled, and roughly 40 Americans died each day from an opioid overdose. In Iowa, healthcare providers wrote nearly 50 opioid prescriptions for every 100 people. One local surgeon gives his insight on the opioid epidemic and shares information on a different technique he uses to manage pain in patients. Here's Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer and part of her conversation with Dr. Michael Dorn. He's a board-certified orthopedic surgeon with Tri-State Specialists and Riverview Surgical Center.
Yeah, we in the orthopedic world, and we also in our group and in our surgery center do other types of surgery as well, general surgery and plastic surgery. And in general surgery, the patients, you know, that's when they get induced oftentimes to narcotics to help with their pain. And so for a lot of patients, it could be the first time in their life they have those medications available to them. The majority do well with it and they don't have problems, but there are some with that. Oftentimes patients with chronic pain as well, chronic issues, have issues with opioids.
And you actually have a new way that you do surgery to help prevent people from having issues with opioids, right?
Yeah, what we've been doing at Riverview Surgery Center is using a medication called Exparel. And what it is a long-acting local anesthetic, specifically called bupivacaine. And it is active in the fat tissues, basically. And so it's a slow-release medication that helps with pain after surgery. And it's been around for a while. And there's been millions of patients who have actually have had it in their surgeries, I think, since 2012. And so it's been around for a little while. It's in good use throughout the country. But we're one of the only centers in Siouxland that uses it. We've had some good results so far.
And what kind of surgeries do you use it for?
So at our center so far, we've used it mostly for orthopedic surgeries, those including fractures, let's say tendon ruptures, nerve surgeries in the upper, like in the arm as well as the leg. We've also used it for general surgery procedures, so those type of surgeries that are around the abdomen, such as, things like a gallbladder surgery.
Do you still prescribe opioids in certain surgeries, or do you try to do this alternative instead?
We do. We try to minimize that. And this medication is one of one tool we have in using a multimodal type approach to try to decrease opioid use. But opioids still serve their purpose, and we need them oftentimes for pain control after surgery. And there's different types. We try to use the minimal amount that we need. But techniques like this have really been able to allow us to use less, and allows patients to take, maybe they would take, let's say, a certain amount before, and maybe, with this kind of block for their pain, they take half of that, so it helps to decrease the use and hopefully decrease any potential issues with using the opioids.
Do you think there are some cases, you said you do occasionally use opioids with people who have other procedures, but if you're someone who has had chronic pain, is there still a use for people who fall in that kind of category, or is it best to try to find some kind of alternative to manage the symptoms that you have?
Yeah, good. That's a good question. So we always deal with that if you have a patient who, let's say, has a broken bone or another issue, and they have chronic opioid use for something else. Oftentimes they're on a pain management contract or something, so they may write for those opioids. But we still can use this technique and other techniques to try to decrease, so they don't have an increase in pain or increase in the need for more opioid use in their post-op course. So these kind of techniques really can help with those patients as well. So, and we're very, very cognizant of that. We try to limit the amount we use narcotics in those type of patients for sure.
Do you find that a certain kind of person or patient is more susceptible to becoming addicted?
Well, we do know that some people have more addictive traits than others. That can be part of it. Each of our bodies are different in how we respond to medications. Sometimes our pain receptors or the way our brain and nervous system processes pain and input can be different. And so some people may be more prone to it. Nothing we know in particular, like in our practice where we see, this type of patient versus another. But if they've had use in the past or had needed excessive narcotics, let's say for another type of procedure in their past, then we definitely will keep that in mind. And that may push us to try to use some more of these modalities to decrease that opioid use. Our main focus is just trying to let people know that we have that available at Riverview. We had good results. I think we've done close to 100 cases with using it so far, and the majority really have liked it. And on the average we get, it's probably about 2 to 3 days where there really is no pain. And one of the nice things about this medication too is that when the pain, after that block wears off for surgery, it's a slow release or a slow transition. So versus oftentimes, if you do a standard type of pain block, once that block wears off, that pain kind of hits you right at once, so there can be a spike in that pain, maybe more opioid use. So it's nice to have a slow transition. And that's a really satisfactory thing for us as surgeons as well as the patients.
That's Dr. Michael Dorn. That's Dr. Michael Dorn with Tri-State Specialists and Riverview. That's Dr. Michael Dorn with Tri-State Specialists and Riverview Surgical Center, located in South Sioux City, Nebraska. And finally today, another small wonder from Jim Skop. August 6, 1945, the atomic bomb explodes over Hiroshima. 3 days later, another over Nagasaki. World War II ends soon, but not until October of that year is the last American released from Camp Amachi, a Japanese-American internment camp not far from Siouxland. Jim Skop has this story.
Where we put our fears. There's very little to see now, but roll after roll after roll of foundations. A procession of rectangles angling down a long slope towards where there once stood a front gate. If you get there in June, the whole expanse will be awash in wildflowers. A bright yellow smiley face on a place you can't help but grimace to remember. Amachi Relocation Camp is much bigger than you can imagine, but it had to be to hold 10,000 Japanese Americans, neighbors we believe, the rest of us, too vulnerable in their ethnic and racial past to side with the U.S. of A. after the horror at Pearl Harbor. After all, some of them still spoke Japanese. So we built camps, 10 of them. We transformed racetracks and other wide open spaces, surrounded them with fences, and filled them with Japanese Americans. If some morning you stand on the broad grounds of what's still there at Camp Amachi, just outside of Granada, Colorado, if you look up and down the rows of the foundations, you can still feel some animosity, hate-generated fear that must have arisen. I am for the immediate removal of every Japanese on the West Coast to a point deep in the interior. I don't mean a nice part of the interior either. Herd them up, pack them off, and give them the inside room of the Badlands. Personally, I hate the Japanese, and that goes for all of them. So wrote newspaper columnist Henry McLemore. And there were other reasons as well, selfish reasons. We're charged with wanting to get rid of the Japs for selfish reasons. Well, we do. It's a question of whether the white man lives in the Pacific Coast or the brown man. They came into this valley to work and they stayed to take over. If all the Japs were removed tomorrow, we'd never miss them in 2 weeks because white farmers can take over and produce everything the Japs grow. And we do not want them back when the war ends. Those are the words of the head of a California Agricultural Association in the Saturday Evening Post in 1942. Hundreds of rudely constructed barracks once stood here, enough for 10,000 men and women and kids who'd been living all up and down the West Coast, all of them herded to places like this by howling fear fanned into racial hatred. Most of what was here is gone now, 75 years later. But the absence of people has not emptied the place of voices, especially if you're alone. Once upon a time, the place was a city. Once, thousands crowded into its mess halls, worked its gardens, created its newspaper, maintained a Great Plains village that became, for better or for worse, a home. Babies were born here. Men and women died on ground beneath your feet and are buried in its sanctuary cemetery, a place you can still visit. Camp Amachi once was flourishing, if a people can be said to flourish in a prison. To call Amachi Relocation Camp a concentration camp may well go too far. It wasn't an American Auschwitz. What's still there in the landscape was never created simply to kill human beings. Still, the images all around you are stunningly reminiscent of black and white photos we've all seen from Germany and Poland. And if you stand there at Camp Amachi, even for a few minutes, the prairie winds all around will whisper in voices that tell you with a vividness that's extraordinary how very easy it is for all of us to be fearful enough to sentence those we don't trust to life beyond a wall, any wall, even walls that will never be seen. For the record, you'll find Camp Amachi just a hop, skip, and a jump from the Santa Fe Trail, the domain of Kit Carson and a host of Western heroes. What could be more American than the way west on the Santa Fe Trail? Strangely enough, that's where you'll find it.
Support for Small Wonders on Siouxland Public Media comes from the Daniels Osborne Law Firm in the Ho-Chunk Center in downtown Sioux City, serving the needs of clients in real estate transactions, business formation and guidance, and personal estate planning. More information is available on Facebook or at danielsosborne.com. And also today, a note that Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds has signed an executive order granting convicted felons the right to vote. And that ends Iowa's place as the only remaining state to broadly deny voting rights to felons. And that's it for this edition of The Exchange. Thanks for listening, and thanks also to Sheila Brummer. I'm Mary Hartnett. We'll see you next week.